We have a busy week this week. We'll have class on Monday. We will not have class on Wednesday, operator. We're going to not do the class on Wednesday, and then we're having an exam on Friday in a different room. So, and then we'll have class on Friday morning, as usual, and then the exam Friday afternoon. And then we'll get back on track. The exam will cover through hidden Markov models, which when I sent through email last night, lecture 18, I meant lecture 18 in the syllabus, our 18th class meeting. In terms of these lecture numbers on the slides, it's roughly through the first part of lecture 13, sort of basic hidden Markov models. I won't cover continuous distributions. I won't ask you to build a speech recognizer on the exam. So that would be fun to give you a data sequence and let you actually crunch through it. But I did want to say about the exam, in a 50-minute exam, I obviously can't ask you really complicated problems. So don't stress out about the exam. This is a graduate class. Everything good you learn about graduate classes, you learn outside of exams and things. So the exam's not going to be tough. Focus on the basics. Make sure you understand the material at the level it was presented in the lectures. I generally look at the lecture notes and try to make problems up that are relevant to the lecture notes. So don't think you need to have understand all the obscure points covered in some of the homework problems. The homework problems were selected mainly to reinforce concepts and make you think a little, but some of them are very involved and we won't go to that level of detail on a 50-minute exam. So just try to understand the basics. And a good rule of thumb I always find is take out a blank piece of paper and see if you can, from memory, write down a summary of what we talked about and what the key points were. And if you can do that, you're probably in pretty good shape. Today we're going to move into Chapter 4. And I'm going to talk about non-parametric estimation techniques. That's essentially what's covered in Chapter 4. And while I'm lecturing today, I thought, well, of course, we had the Academy Awards last night, and that's a nice example of statistical inference, right? So I'm hoping by the end of class, somebody will think, I would like you to think about a good example or good demonstration of the use of pattern recognition in the Academy Awards last night. So while I'm lecturing, think about that and see if hopefully somebody can come up with some interesting perspectives. So let's talk about density estimation. Supervised learning assumes that we know the form of the underlying density function, which is often not true in real applications. We've talked about techniques where we assume Gaussian distributions, and then we've learned techniques how to estimate the parameters of the Gaussian distribution. All parametric densities are unimodal. They have a single local maximum, such as a Gaussian, whereas many practical problems involve multimodal densities. We discuss mixture distributions as a way to deal with this. For example, we talked a little bit last class about speech recognition. If you collect samples of males, females, and children speaking a sound, typically a vowel, you will find that the average location of the peaks in the spectrum vary as a function of the sex of the speaker, male, female, the age of the speaker, adult versus child, and other factors like that. So when you're trying to model data that is multimodal like that, it's tempting to use a Gaussian mixture distribution, or it's tempting to use a non-parametric approach if the distribution is really messy and doesn't really fit any kind of functional form. And in fact, non-parametric techniques were very popular in the early days of pattern recognition because they're, in a sense, so easy to estimate. So what is an example of a non-parametric technique? Well, a very simple example of a non-parametric technique is when you compute a histogram from some data. And you call that the probability, and you show that to your professor and say, here, this is the probability density function. And what it typically looks very noisy. But you say, well, that's a very, that distribution is a very good model of that particular data set. This is, to some extent, reality. But what we're all about in this class is trying to do some inference to get at the truth. So even though that particular data set, that distribution may model a particular data set, you always have the problem of how well does that data set model your overall application. And that's essentially what the problem, that one of the major problems we're dealing with in this course. So non-parametric procedures can be used with arbitrary distributions and without the assumption that the forms of the underlying densities are known. They are data-driven, which simply means they're estimated from the data, and of course suffer the same challenges with respect to overfitting. When you show that histogram computed on a particular data set, that histogram is very specific to that data set. There's no guarantee that that's the best model for another data set. Of course, if you average, one way to get at the true distribution might be to collect lots of different data sets, compute lots of different histograms, and then average them. And that's a technique that we'll talk about later in the course, techniques like that. There are two types of non-parametric methods. One is to estimate the posterior here, P of X given omega sub J directly. And the other is to bypass probability and go directly to a posterior, an a posteriori probability estimation, T of omega sub J given X. So we know from Bayes' rule that we can sort of relate either of these two. We can relate these two to each other using prior probabilities. And ultimately, we're interested in the computing these posteriors, and we'll talk about ways to do either both of these. Neural networks are an example of an approach which became very popular because, for one reason, was because they directly estimate these posterior probability distributions, and you bypass essentially worrying about the priors, likelihoods, and those kinds of things. On the other hand, I would say, neural networks had mixed levels of success in the 80s, 90s. A lot of the Bayesian techniques have become very popular, and then the two techniques have kind of merged, and there are a lot of different variants of these things. But what we're going to talk about today is this data-driven approach to estimating a distribution. So the basic idea in density estimation is that a vector X will fall in a region R with probability P, where P is the integral over that region R of the probability density function for X times dx. This value P is a smoothed or average version of the density function P of X. So what that says, in sort of a mathematical way is something that you're used to doing. With histograms, which is if the actual distribution is smooth, we can essentially approximate this as a series of rectangular or square regions. And that's essentially what you do when you compute a histogram, because usually when you compute a histogram, you have to set up a bin width, and then you have to count how many elements fall within that bin width, and then you assign the density function of value based on the number of objects that fell in that bin. So suppose n samples are drawn independently and identically distributed, what we call IID, according to a distribution P of X. The probability that K of these fall, of these n samples fall in R, this region, is given by, we can use this binomial distribution and write n things k at the time times the probability of p sub k times the probability 1 minus p raised to the n minus k power. So this is following our analogy where we're going to approximate the probability by this value p, and therefore then we can compute based on that the probability that if we draw n samples, k of these fall in that region using this binomial distribution. And the expected value for k, the expected value or the expected number of samples that will fall in this region is just n times this probability p. Now, the ML estimate of this probability p sub k given theta is, in fact, just k over n, which is approximately equal to p. That's also something that can be shown based on the properties of this binomial distribution. And it's a derivation similar to what we showed. We showed that the estimate, the ML estimate of the mean is essentially just taking the, computing the mean as you're used to taking the arithmetic average of the data. So therefore, the ratio K over N is in fact a good estimate for the probability P, and hence for the density function P of X. Now, in practice, what's the problem with estimating distributions this way? Okay, so all we've really done here is mathematically explain what a histogram is. So what's the problem with this kind of an approach when you're dealing with real data sets? So how do we make this distribution converge to the true distribution in theory? What do we have to do to the region in this kind of an analysis to get it to converge to the true distribution? Smaller, right? It's sort of like, it's the same argument or the same approach when you approximate an integral. You approximate an integral as a sum of these rectangles, and then you let the width of the rectangle go to zero. So the same thing here. We could make this converge to the actual, the sort of quote-unquote true estimate of probability distribution if we make this region go to zero. But what's the problem in practice with making that region, the size of that region, go to zero? Why can't you compute histograms in practice with very small bin sizes? No, just even simpler than that. No? It's simpler than that. You have a lot of... You mean the computation of assigning data to the bins? You would need a lot more data to get through. Why? And the bins are smaller, right? So if you take a fixed data set, let's say 100 points, I don't care what they really are, if you set the bin size really, really small, like, you know, these numbers, let's say that you randomly draw 100 numbers between 0 and 1, and you'd compute a histogram using a bin size of 0.1, well, if you're using a uniform random number generator, you would think, well, I should get 10 numbers in every bin. Okay, then you shrink that bin size from 0.1 to 0.01. Now you say, well, I should, if I've got 100 numbers, I should, on the average, get one number in every bin. But in fact, what's going to happen is a number of the bins are going to be empty. So that's a problem. You're going to run out of data, essentially, or you're going, the width of the bins are going to, you're going to end up with all these zero bins. So you could offset that by collecting more data, going from 100 to 1,000. But at some point in practice, you run out of data if you want to make the bin size really, really small. And the question we want to ask is there a better way to use those data points to approximate the distribution? Those data points are real. They tell you something about what actually happened. For example, if we think, did anybody watch the Academy Awards last night? Do you follow these things as graduate students? No? All right, so I won't use that example today. That was the example I planned to talk about today, so now I'll think of something else. But anyway, those 100 points, those 100 samples that you got are real data. They tell you something about the process. So we would like to make use of those in an intelligent way, and that's essentially what the techniques we're going to talk about today try to do. So let's assume P of X is continuous and that the region R is so small that P of X does not vary significantly within it, so that we can write that this integral over R of the probability distribution can be approximated just by P of X times the volume V, where X is a point within R and V is the volume enclosed by R. And P of X then is approximately K over N divided by V. So that's a simple demonstration of how we can estimate the probability distribution from this approximation. A demonstration of the non-parametric density estimation is this little graphic on the left. It's a little bit small, but I think you can see the idea. The true probability was chosen to be 0.7. The curves vary as a function of the number of samples n, and we see that the binomial distribution peaks strongly at the true probability. So this is an example of the kind of thing we're after, that we would like to have a way of estimating a smooth distribution using the data points that were given and trying to estimate the probability distribution using this kind of an approach. Now, we'll generalize this in a moment. So we'll sort of come back to this concept. As we talked about, V cannot become arbitrarily small because we reach a point where no samples are contained in V. So we cannot get convergence in this way. So there's an alternate approach to this. V cannot be allowed to become small since the number of samples is always limited. One will have to accept a certain amount of variance in the ratio K over N. Theoretically, if an unlimited number of samples is available, then we can circumvent this difficulty. But, of course, an unlimited number of samples is never really available. To estimate the density of X, we form a sequence of regions, R1, R2, and so on, containing X. The first region contains one sample. The second region contains two samples, and so on. So we're going to let V sub N be the volume of this region, R sub N, and K sub N is the number of samples falling into R sub N. And Pn of X is going to be the nth estimate for P of X. So P sub N of X is going to be K sub N over N divided by V sub N. And K sub N then is this the nth number of samples falling in R sub N. And the question we're going to ask is, under what conditions will this P sub N of X converge to P of X as we let N become large? So three necessary conditions should apply if we want P sub N of X to converge to P of X. The first condition should be that this volume should go to zero as N goes to infinity. The second condition should be that the number of samples within this region should go to infinity, as n goes to infinity. And then the third is that the number of samples in this region divided by the total number of samples, that should go to zero as n goes to infinity. So these are just sort of three somewhat obvious conditions, but just formally stating what it's going to take for this p sub n of x to converge to p of x using this kind of a sampling approach. Now, there are two different ways of obtaining sequences of regions that satisfy these conditions. One way is to shrink an initial region where v sub n, the volume, is proportional to 1 over the square root of n, and then to show that p sub n of x does in fact converge to p of x. And this is called the Parsons window estimation method. We specify k sub n as some function of n, such as k sub n is equal to the square root of n. And the volume v sub n is grown until it encloses k sub n neighbors of x. And this is called the k sub n nearest neighbor rule, or the k nearest neighbor rule. So, in one case, we're specifying the volume directly as a function of n. In the second case, we're letting the volume vary so that it always encloses k sub n data points. So here's a visualization of this. We have in the first case the situation where we simply set the volume based on n. The volume here is 1. And here we have the volume where we set the volume based on the number of elements in the volume. So in the neighborhood of x, we grow this volume until it eventually encloses one data point. Whereas here we just decide this is the size of the volume and hopefully there's a data point within it. So here we have a case for n equals 4. We're shrinking the volume. And in this case, we've got one point on the boundary and the other three points are outside. Here we have the number of data points is the square root of n or 2. So we adjust the volume so that it encloses at least 2 data points. And then here's a case, n equals 9. Volume's getting smaller here, n equals 9, which means the volume has to enclose 3 data points and so forth. So these are two different strategies for constructing these regions, and then we're going to essentially use, you can think of this sort of as a bin size. We're going to use this region to approximate the overall probability distribution. And then out of that will result several estimation methods. One is the Parsons window method, and one is the nearest neighbor approach. So let's first talk about the Parsons window approach. The Parsons window approach to estimate densities assume that the region Rn is a d-dimensional hypercube, just means a square in multiple dimensions. So the volume V sub n is going to be some constant h sub n raised to the dth power, since it has d dimensions associated with it. And h sub n is going to be the length of the edge of the region. So we will let phi of u be a window function defined as follows. Phi of u is going to be equal to 1 when its argument, the magnitude of its argument, is less than or equal to a half for all d dimensions, and it's going to be equal to 0 otherwise. So this is essentially just you could think of this as like a unit pulse. If its argument, it's got a length that extends from minus 1/2 to plus 1/2 in d dimensions. So all we're really saying here is if the value of u is within that cube, this indicator function will take on a value of 1. Otherwise, the indicator function will take on a value of 0. So from this, we can actually build up, using this rather simple definition, we can actually build up an estimate of the probability density function. So let's look at how we can do that. So if we can write that phi of x minus x sub I divided by h sub n is equal to unity if xi falls within the hypercube of volume v sub n centered at x and equal to zero otherwise. So this is a translation and scaling of this function such that you have this hypercube which has a length, one side whose length is h sub n, and that hypercube is centered around the point x. And if x sub I is close enough to x, such that it's within that hypercube, phi is equal to 1, otherwise phi is equal to 0. Okay? We follow. That's actually the key step, because what we've now done is we've created what you might call a basis function that is a function of the actual data points x sub I. Yeah, maybe I should draw a picture. So this translated and scaled version of phi this is just a way of saying we have some region out here centered around x, and if x sub I is within that cube, phi will be equal to 1. Otherwise, phi will be equal to 0 if x sub I is outside of that cube. Okay? So the number of samples in this hypercube is k sub n can be written as the sum from I equals 1 to n of phi times x minus x sub I over h sub n. That's just a way of writing a little bit of mathematical sleight of hand, but that's just a way of saying for each data point in this cube, we're going to accumulate 1. And since k sub n is the number of data points within this cube, we can write k sub n this way. So now that we have an estimate for k sub n, we can write the estimate for pn of x is pn of x is equal to 1 over n times the sum from I equals 1 to n of 1 over v sub n times this phi, just using the fact that earlier we said the estimate for Pn of x is k sub n over n divided by v sub n. Now we're just replacing k sub n with this function, which is a function of the data points now. Now the interesting thing about this is now we have a function, we have actually an estimate of the probability distribution in terms of the data points themselves, the x sub i's. So p sub n of x estimates p of x as an average of functions of x and the samples x sub I. I like to think of this as related to the sampling theorem. These sampling functions, phi, can actually be general. In fact, you're probably thinking, okay, in the not-too-distant future, he's going to let these phis be something like Gaussians rather than being uniforms. And, in fact, you can do that kind of thing. So this is just really a mathematical way of expressing what you're doing when you approximate a probability distribution with a histogram. So let's see now if we can generalize this or expand this so that we use normal distributions. So this is an example of a Parsons window approximation using Gaussian kernels, where P of X, our target distribution, is the normal distribution on the range zero, with a mean of 0 and a variance of 1. So we're going to let phi of u be this Gaussian instead of this step function. And we're going to let h sub n be h1 divided by the square root of n, where h1 is a known parameter. You can think of it as a constant for the moment. Thus, our p sub n of x is 1 over n times the sum from I equals 1 to n of 1 over h sub n times phi of x minus xi over h sub n. Only phi now, instead of being a binary function, is this continuous this Gaussian kernel, essentially. So we can now see that in this approach that p sub n of x is an average of the normal densities, and it's centered around the samples x sub I. So here we have the case when n is equal to 1, we have a single Gaussian for different values of this parameter h1. Now, if we increase n to 10, we have these three distributions, and you see that what's happening now is with n equals 10, we have the sum of multiple Gaussians, because we're going to have 10 of these here, and it sort of depends somewhat on the variance, on the size of this cube, but when the cube becomes small, you can see essentially that the Gaussians don't overlap as much. And now you can begin to see the character of the individual Gaussians appearing. Whereas when this parameter H1 is large, then all the Gaussians have a very broad variance, and you're essentially when you sum these together, you get a Gaussian. Here we have the example where n is equal to 100, and then in the limits, when n becomes infinity, then we do get convergence to our normal distribution. So the Parsons window approach is a way to take actual data points and generate an estimate for the probability distribution based on those data points, but using a generator function, whether it's a uniform function or a Gaussian function. Now, that is a process very similar, you could say, to the sampling theorem where if you remember from your digital signal processing, when we represent a sampled signal, it's a weighted sum of sync functions. And the finer you sample the signal, the more syncs you have, and the smoother the distribution gets. It's the same kind of a principle here. And in fact, you can relate the accuracy of the approximation to the number of data points and that kind of thing. So the Parsons approach is our first non-parametric technique for estimating a probability density function in that it involves the actual data points themselves and a weighted sum of these phi functions, and you could let the phi functions be whatever you want. Uniform and Gaussian are good choices. When you're doing what you know as a traditional histogram, you're essentially using a phi function which is uniform. And when you're doing Gaussian mixture, you could think of this as an alternate kind of Gaussian mixture modeling technique if you let the phi functions be Gaussian. Right, because what we learned in chapter 3 was that if you think of a Gaussian mixture, that's essentially a weighted sum of Gaussians, very similar to the Parsons window. The only difference between the what is the difference between the Parsons window approach and the Gaussian mixture modeling approach we discussed in the previous chapter. How would you describe the difference between these two? They both have the same form. The probability distribution is the sum of Gaussians, weighted Gaussians, right? With the Gaussian mixture distribution, what was the key? We had essentially a mixture weight here. We called it C. With the Parsons window approach, we have this hypercube. What's the principal difference between the two? If you wanted to apply this to estimating the probability density function given when I give you a data set, how would you describe or summarize the difference in the two approaches? Well, how would you estimate the parameters of the Gaussian mixture model if I give you a data set? But for a given number, let's assume we just fix the number of mixtures at 2. How do you actually estimate the parameters of that model? What theorem did we discuss, which was the general framework in which we would estimate the parameters of those mixture distributions? And we didn't discuss too many theorems. Starts with an E, ends with an M, and has theorem in the name. See, that's interesting. What theorem did we discuss in Chapter 3? It's already slipped out of your short-term memory. What was the basic, powerful theorem that we discussed in Chapter 3? EM, thank you. And how did we describe EM? EM was a framework in which we could do what? Iteratively estimate of our model, given data, right? So if you wanted to use a Gaussian mixture distribution for this model, you would estimate the parameters of the model using EM. And we described how to do that in a hidden Markov model context, and I also linked you to a reference that describes it, how to do that for a general multivariate Gaussian distribution. But you can see the difference. With the Parsons window, we're using the data directly and we're not optimizing the weights. The weights are pre-selected to based on the size of this cube, based on your bin size, essentially. With the EM approach, we're actually estimating the parameters of the model. We're trying to optimize them to maximize the overall likelihood of the model given the data. Now, the Parsons window predates the EM approach, of course, because you're probably sitting there thinking, well, why is he teaching me Parsons when he's already taught EM? Well, Parsons window predates the EM approach. This was known long before we had these techniques like EM. So this was a very popular technique in statistics at one time because it was data-driven. But since then, we've developed much more powerful techniques. That's not to say this is a bad method. This is a very reasonable method. And EM, as we talked about, will actually overfit the data if you're not careful. So, again, there's no sort of right or wrong answer. It just depends on the details of the application. Now, remember we said there were two ways we could We could define this volume. One was we could a priori select the size of the volume, and that resulted in the pars and window approach. Or the second is we could let the size of the volume grow to include a pre-specified number of points, and we said that was the k-nearest neighbor estimation approach. So the goal for the k-nearest neighbor estimation approach was to the goal is sort of a solution for the problem of the unknown best window function. The approach is to estimate the density function using real data points. And we're going to let the cell volume be a function of the training data. So we're going to center a cell about X and let it grow until it captures KN samples, K sub N being equal to some function of N. The K sub N are called the KN nearest neighbors of X. Now, that's a little bit abstract. We'll make this very concrete in a moment. But let's think about the philosophy here. I like to call it philosophy. Because we actually used this in the early days of speech recognition, for example. Suppose you have a large data set that you believe accurately models the problem space you're working in. And suppose I give you a test vector and ask you to classify this test vector. What's a very reasonable thing to do if you think your data set is very large, is adequately large? So let me give you an example from teaching. As students, you all like to think you're unique, right? But of course, as a teacher who's taught for many years, I've deduced that there's maybe 30 different types of students that you encounter. So, and you actually do the same thing with professors. There's maybe you might have in your mind 5 different types of professors: the ones you never take a class from, the ones you always want to take a class from, and, you know, somewhere in between. And the game we play at the beginning of the semester is you try to figure out who I am, hopefully before the drop date, and I try to figure out who you are, so that if I think, you know, we're not going to get along, I'm kind of careful or whatever about that, right? I used to tell students, I can actually, after about the first 3 lectures or so in a class, particularly an undergraduate class, I can pretty much guess with a very good degree of accuracy what final grades are going to be for students. And that's, I know that's depressing and that's a little bit controversial, but that's because I've seen enough students that I can, well, all that I really do is take each of you and compare you to these 30 prototypes I have in my head. I don't have 30, but, you know, whatever, you get the idea. And you do the same thing with professors. Oh, he's, you know, a theoretician. Oh, he's an easy guy. You know, that kind of thing. So what is the principle of K nearest neighbor? It's a really interesting principle, and that's why I like to spend a couple minutes on the philosophy of it. And I'll explain it in the context of speech recognition in a moment. If you have a really large data set, and I give you a new test vector, what is it reasonable to assume? If you think about the process that I just described, it's reasonable to assume that that test vector is very similar to one of the data points in your set, which is what you do with professors. Now, what's the danger of this? This is actually a very simple, very good pattern recognition algorithm. Go out and collect a large amount of data, and then just find the data that's closest to the actual data point that's closest to your test vector and assign it to whatever class that training data point is assigned to. And that's what I love about pattern recognition. Pattern recognition is very simple in the end. So what's wrong with this approach? This is a good approach, except What's wrong with this approach? Now think about the problem of speech recognition. For this approach to work well, your training data has to cover the entire space. Well, in a context, in an application like speech recognition, what is the entire space? The entire space is every possible person speaking under every possible recording condition. Not feasible. We actually, in the early days of speech recognition, built a speech recognizer on this principle, and it performed very well because we were working with a controlled data set. And that was very, very illuminating to me because I thought, gosh, this is so simple. But it makes sense. Just take each one of you and find a speaker in your database that's closest to you and use that as a comparison point. What's the other problem with this approach from a computational point of view if we talk about a problem like speech recognition? Right, so I may need a billion, you know, to do speech recognition for everybody in the world, I may need a billion data points in my training data. So that's it's not computationally efficient to do this. What do we try to do? What is this course about? What do we try to do to get around the k-nearest neighbor problem? Well, we try to parameterize these distributions using Gaussians or Gaussian mixtures so that we can reduce the computation. But the end result is not much different than a k-nearest neighbor. We're essentially, the only reason we use all these other approaches is to reduce computations and to somehow smooth these distributions. So another value of the k-nearest neighbor approach is to actually use this as a base, as like a reference or a baseline performance, so that you can compare your algorithms to this approach. And that's another way that we've actually used this as a baseline condition to give you some idea of what kind of performance you can expect on an application. So if we follow this approach, two possibilities can occur. The density is high near X, and therefore the cell will be small, which provides good resolution. The density is low, and therefore the cell will grow large and stop until higher density regions are reached. So we have a problem here that, I mean, this is an interesting approach because it allows the region, the model that you're building, you'll have these volumes of different sizes depending on how many data points there are in your training set in that region of the space. Because the size of the region that we're using in approximating the distribution is proportional to it's fixed at the number of data points, not the volume of the cell. So we can obtain a family of estimates by setting kn equal to some constant over the square root of n and choosing different values for k1. And I actually thought the next slide was an example on that. I might have that. Okay, yeah, let's. Now, the other thing we want to worry about, we still want to worry about the probability of the data. We want to somehow factor that in. So let's now talk about how we can extend these techniques to estimate the probability of the class assignment given X from a set of n labeled samples. So let's place a cell of volume V around X and capture K samples. K sub I samples amongst K turned out to be labeled with class omega sub I. Not all of these are going to be labeled with the I's class, but K sub I represents the ones that are labeled with the I's class, so that the probability P sub n of X and omega sub I is just equal to K sub I over N divided by V instead of K over N divided by V. So a reasonable estimate for the probability of omega sub I given x is essentially this. Using this approach, we have the probability of omega sub I given x, and that's just p sub n of x and omega sub I divided by the total probability by summing over the c classes of this p sub n, and that simplifies to just k sub I over k. So again, k sub I over k is just a fraction of samples within the cell that are labeled as some omega sub I. Now, again, not that's something you've done when you compute a histogram, is you just approximate the probability with the number of samples in that class divided by the total number of samples in that cell. This is just a way of demonstrating that that's a principled estimate. So we'll pick this up next class, and we'll finish up with showing you the how the nearest neighbor approach works.